is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Oklahoma City, 1952. The recovery from the Second War, the returning veterans, and The Leopard is Loose, a new work of fiction, a novel by veteran novelist Stephen Harrigan. Steve, congratulations and a very good evening to you. 1952 Oklahoma City is the structure of the story of what happens when an animal escapes the Oklahoma City Zoo. What was Oklahoma City in 1952? What was its work? What was its vision of itself? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening, John. It's great to be with you. And thanks for having me on the show. And it's really great to talk to a novelist I admire, even though I think it was many years ago I read American Falls, but still think fondly, very fondly of it.
Thank you.
Oklahoma City in 1952. This book is based on a true incident, which occurred in 1950 when a leopard escaped from the Lincoln Park Zoo in Oklahoma City. And I lived in Oklahoma City at the time as a very, very young boy, and I've moved the action of the story forward a couple of years so I could account for some of my own memories. But Oklahoma City was we forget how instantly it arrived on the scene. One day in 1889, it appeared during the Oklahoma land run. And it was sort of instantly staked out, and it was, it grew up fast and furious, and it encountered, like the rest of the country, encountered World War II. And this book is set in the time of a dynamic city and a dynamic culture, I think, recovering from that war, trying to reorient itself, recharge itself, trying to, re-identify itself in a new era and move on into the future.
Yes, the derricks are no longer as prominent as they were earlier in the century, but the oil fields are the future, and we now know so are the natural gas fields. This mm-hmm. is a rich part of the landscape. But you introduce us to the Brennans, and you tell the Brennan story from the point of view of Grady, who is 5 years old, Grady McClarty. He is the Brennan grandson. But a tragedy has happened to Grady and to his older brother Dan and to his mother Bethy. What happened?
Well, in the background of the story is Grady and Danny, the two little boys, their father was killed shortly after World War II. He was a fighter pilot in the war. And it was a test pilot afterward and was killed in a plane crash. And Bethy, their mother, and Danny and Grady have moved back to Oklahoma City, just like many widowed mothers moved back with their families after the war. And they're living in a kind of family compound with in a garage apartment behind the main house where their grandparents and their Aunt Vivian lives, and below their two uncles who live in the top floor of the garage apartment, who have been, who have come back from the war much shattered and much changed and are trying to put their own lives back together. So it's a family story set in a time and a place that was a little destabilized, a little uncertain, and like I said, trying to move on into the future.
Yes, welcome Oedipus. Now, Big Dan Brennan, and his wife come from Kansas. And that's right. An important piece of the detail here, because they are extremely careful, conscientious, and excellent parents. And they want that for their children, but it's not possible. And I felt that as I was reading Dan, as he would encounter Frank or Emmett or Bethy or the problems of the family, that mm-hmm. he wanted to get back to a period of his life before the war. And he's dealing with something that, well, at one time, Frank says to him, "You can't know what I saw."
Exactly. Yeah. Big Dan, Daniel Brennan, who is the grandfather in the book, Grady's grandfather, was shipped out on a troop ship in World War I, but caught the flu during the pandemic in 1918. So he He survived the pandemic, but did not experience the war. And it's beyond his real comprehension to understand what his two sons have been through in some very, very heavy fighting throughout Europe and World War II. So there's tension, automatic tension between them and their parents, and it kind of overflows into the rest of the family.
Right. You do us the favor of the research about what was Frank and Emmett's experience. And this is the 45th Thunderbird Division, the 157th Regiment, that saw horrible action in Italy all during 43-44. And it's just a piece of the story is that they continued into Germany and were present, at least in part, as the American army discovered the death camps and the work camps in 1945. So Frank and Emmett represent what we call now PTSD. What about Grady's dad, Bert? He's missing in action, but it's left Bethy damaged. How so? His wife.
Well, Bethy had endured the shock. She was an army nurse in World War II, taking care, just as my mother was, taking care of wounded soldiers coming home from the Pacific Theater. And she and Bert were married, and he was killed suddenly after the war in a shocking plane crash. And so she is someone who is experiencing her own version of PTSD, at the same time having to raise two children without a father. So it's a family that is, you know, a very loving family, but has been shaken deeply by the events of the war. And to Grady, he's aware, he's a five-year-old kid. And by the way, I'm telling the story through the eyes of his older self, his much older self. So I have a kind of ability as the narrator I've created to examine the feelings Grady is having. But for Grady, he doesn't understand. He just knows that there was a war. He doesn't know what that word means. He doesn't know what it represents. But he's aware in a kind of, you know, childish, you know, amorphous way that something bad happened, and it did something bad to his family that they haven't quite recovered from.
Grady is a sensitive person, and he observes through the filter of his senior self tensions in the town that are the war. We've talked about those that are prosperity, that are you'd have to say the moving away from Catholic life into something that's in transformation. This happened all across America as the church pews emptied from the middle of the 20th century until the end of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Grandfather keeps up the routine and the ceremony of going to Our Lady of Perpetual Help, I believe, is the church.
Right, which is the real church in Oklahoma City.
And never more obvious about the tension of Frank and Emmett the day they refused to take communicant. The day they refuse to be communicant members. What does Grady make of that when they stay in the pew and their parents go forward?
Well, he observes it and doesn't quite know what it means. But and again, it's not that they're refusing to take communion. In those days in the Catholic Church, and probably perhaps now, if you were in a state of mortal sin, which was, you know, a kind of broadly defined concept, you were not supposed to go to communion. And so, you know, these guys have been through a lot, both during the war and after the war. And according to the precepts of the church, they are not supposed to take communion. So there's it's an observable rift in the family for Grady. You know, there's one part of his family that is in good with the church, is obeying all the protocols and doing everything they should. There's the other family, that part of the family, Frank and Emmett, that in their way are kind of rebelling against the strictures of the church and to some degree the strictures of society, and, you know, exploring this new world that is kind of opening up, as you mentioned. You know, the pews are starting to empty, and they may be among the first people to empty those pews.
The leopard escapes, and it becomes a bulletin on the local television. I love this. Every once in a while, the whole town's being updated, and Bethy, in her anxiety, insists the children don't play outside anymore. Frank and Emmett, however, are energized by the idea of going leopard hunting. And because you based this on an historical incident, was this a panic for all of Oklahoma City? About 250,000 people, over 65 square miles, you report. Did they have bulletins? Was it in the newspaper every day?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was an exciting event. It was a galvanizing event and a terrifying event for lots of people. It's hard to imagine now when we live in a world of total saturation news coverage. And this might be a story for 10 minutes today. But at that time, it was national news. There was a big story about it in Life magazine. This leopard was prowling through this American city, this sort of prototypical American city. It had escaped from the zoo. Everybody was out on the streets, out in the hinterlands with their hunting rifles and their hunting dogs looking for this leopard. And children were kept home from school. Children were kept in their houses. It was, I don't remember it. I was 2 years old when the leopard escaped, but I remember hearing about it and sort of, imbibing the sort of broad fear that people had and the excitement that people had during this event, which was, as I said, really a striking news story at the time.
It occurred to me as I was reading your book that this night, it took place in 1950, you base it in 52, but the leopard represents the paranoia that America went through in that period after the Second War, when we were sure there were more villains. And in this instance, 1950, that would have been the villains of communism, the attack in Korea, the threats by Stalin. All of that would have been an expression of permanent American anxiety, something Bethy experiences. Now, you're not writing a history, you're writing people's reactions, their emotional intellect. And I accept that. But the Brennans are going through the same thing that American history tells us the whole country went through. There was a Life magazine picture of a woman staring at the skies. You know, we're keeping our eyes open because any moment the Soviet paratroopers could be aboard. And I take it that Oklahoma City experienced all that. That's what the leopard triggers.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real thing. It was a real leopard. It's not symbolic, but it is representative, I think, of an overall destabilization, a sense that all is not right with the world after all. The war was won, but there are aftershocks. And I think the leopard, for many of these people in real life, and certainly for Frank and Emmett, in the book, who went out to hunt the leopard, were a lot of these people, I think, were glad to be back in action. They're not caught in the undertow of a post-World War world anymore. Their skills and the abilities that they learned during the war are of use again. Right. And I think you used the word energized earlier. I think that's exactly right. These people are supercharged by the opportunity to take action and actually do something.
The book is The Leopard is Loose, a novel by Stephen Harrigan. Also in Oklahoma City is the beginning of the conversation about civil rights when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.